Okay.
Hey, Scott.
Hi, how are you, Polly? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the book group. And I'm so excited. I can't tell you what a celebration this book is. It's such an unexpected gift to have Lou Reed back in our lives in this way. And you guys have all just brought him to life. And it's really been a pleasure. So thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I thought maybe we could start kind of with as many know, Lou Reed came here to Martha's Vineyard in 1997. Barbara Dacey here at MBY Radio interviewed him. And he played at the Hot Tin Roof that night. And we have photos from it and stuff. And the Velvets came in 1969. And in the interview with Barbara Dacey, he couldn't remember if he had been here before, but in fact, he has been here twice. And he's always been a big part of our rotation. And me personally, huge fan. And I know you are too. And that's how things started out for you. So even though you've chronicled it in the book, I thought maybe we'd start by just letting us know about how you came to be friends and how Lou came into your life.
That's a great question. So, like most young people, I was in my late teens and I discovered Lou through my older brother, which is how a lot of music was discovered back in the late 70s, early 80s. Before the internet, before social media, it was the influencer in your life was your older sibling or cousin. Anyway, he and I bought a few Lou Reed records at the local mall. There was vinyl at that time, and the first one was Rock and Roll Animal, and then I loved that so much that I went and bought his new record at the time was New Sensations, and I say this in the book, I couldn't believe that these were the same artists, like this was the same person, the voice, the subject matter was cons similar, but just everything about it was different, and I was really just enthralled by that. I loved that. Just that voice, that those lyrics, that those ideas he was putting out there. And when you're in your late teens and I'm ready to go to college, you're so impressionable, and it really helps you form. And that music definitely helped me find my voice, I think, and what I was interested in and what I liked. And I like writing, and it helped me kind of solidify that. So anyway, that's 1984. And then I met him in 1986 for the first time in New York when Mistrial came out. I met him and I made a comment to him at that, like it was a record event of some sort. I said, "Hey, the guitar work on this song, Video Violence, is very similar." Because at this point, I was knee deep into Lou and the Velvets. It reminded me of, the song I Heard Her Call My Name from the second record, White Light, White Heat. And he said, "Wow, that's interesting that you thought that. It is a similar concept. It was, I was trying to channel Albert Ayler, Ornette Coleman, using guitars versus using a saxophone, using guitars and creating that sound, that sound of atonality and of, free jazz, but free jazz with a guitar." So that concept was something that was really strong in his music. And he was pleased that I remember that I brought that up. Anyway, met him a couple of years later at the Grammys. When I was in finishing up college, I was an intern at the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, the folks that
Wow,
use
yeah, how cool.
certify records. And I met him at the Grammys, he and Sylvia. And I just talked to him for about, 10 minutes, told him what I was doing, and I mentioned to him, I said, "Hey, I read that you're doing a record with John Cale on behalf of Andy Warhol." He goes, "Wow, how did you know that?" And I go, "Well, I read it." He goes, "Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet. This is just when New York was coming out."
This is Songs for Drella. You had known, you had the inside scoop.
I don't know why I knew. I read it somewhere, so he didn't know what I had read, but clearly his label had started to promote it and or at least leaked it. But he was really, at that point, he had moved over to Sire from RCA and was working on New York. And I don't think New York had, I think it may have just released at that time. Because I'm trying to remember, was it 89? No, if it was 89 that it was released.
And Songs for Drella was 90, so it was probably between there.
Right. But I met him in like March of or February of 88.
Oh, I see.
Anyway, so that if the timeline's correct, anyway, we just talked and it was just a really nice interaction. And then fast forward, 12 years, 13 years later, I'm in the music business at this point. I had worked at RCA, Arista, BMG, and then I had moved on to AOL Music in 2001. And we had a huge audience. This is when AOL was the thing. We had a big audience, and I said, "Well, all, me and my colleagues, all my friends, we started to bring artists that we loved to our platform." And I said, "I need to bring Lou here. He has a new record coming out called The Raven. I read about that. I'd love to." And they go for it. So I literally sat down. I reached out to a couple of people that knew Lou, and I said, "I'd like to meet with him. I think I can help him." He wrote me back a day later, said, "Who are you? Why do I, why, what do you want with, to, what do you want to know about me?" I explained who I was, where I worked. He then said, "Okay, let's grab lunch." And we met probably a week later in New York at Pastis, which was a place in the West Village.
All
And we spent 3 hours, 3.5 hours together just talking. And, he was so open, and he knew when he met me that I knew my stuff. But also, I was a fan, but I was also somehow he knew that I was to be trusted. Like, he knew that if he was going to share stuff with me, I was going to give him an honest answer, but I was also going to be, I wasn't going to exploit the relationship, if you will.
right.
Because I think a lot of people that have come across in his world, he had a lot of challenges with label people and with management over the years. And I think he had developed a fairly good BS. Can I curse? A
Yeah.
BS, okay, bullshit detector. And he knew that I was for real. So we met, and then he called me the next day and he said, "Hey, will you help me with this?" And so it just started that way. And he just brought me in, and we, and now the next, well, 11 years of his life until he passed, we were very close and very we f friends. And he got me into Tai Chi. And that's, I guess how I came to be involved with the book.
It's so exciting. I mean, what a great idea, first of all. I'm interested in your relationship because the thread throughout the book, for me at least, is through the conversations with the different interviews that you did. As Lori said, Lou was many people's best friend, and he had many roles in different relationships, like Doc Thomas was his mentor, and Jonathan Richman seemed like more of a student. Hal Wilner, more of a partner and an equal. They had that radio show, and he was, obviously really important to his career. And then Master Ren, his teacher. So I'm wondering, where would you say you fall in with your relationship? What was it like? Was it like mutual music fans? Like, I know at one point he had sent you guys off to meet with the label, and, like he trusted you so much. And I'm wondering what it felt like just as a relationship.
I felt like I had like won the lottery in a sense, because you know how it is as a fan of music and different music, and they always say you don't want to meet your heroes because you're only going to be disappointed, right? Because they're not who they are. And
Totally.
I just found it to be the exact opposite. I found it to be very, oh, it was a, he was very open and very honest and very trusting. And in the beginning when I first met him, he was definitely like, "Hey, you ask this question, I'm going to give you this answer, this, I don't want to do this, I will do this," like just very direct, which I think for a lot of people, they were not always prepared to how to deal with that. And I was just like, "Okay, Lou, let's try this then." And just kind of like a relationship where I was kind of like, "Okay, here's who this person is, who has presented himself through music, through his records, through his performances, through his interviews. But then here's the person that I've learned to know." And it's the same person, but it's a richer, deeper kind of interaction that goes beyond that surface kind of presentation, more to like, "Hey, what are you interested in? What are the things that you like to do? Why do you like to do that?" And he taught me just a ton, right? So I felt like I was in many ways kind of a friend, a student, a collaborator. I had him to my house. I had him, he's met most of my family. Like I really felt like we were, in many ways, it was just a really nice kind of relationship. I think I never really wanted anything from him, right? Like, I think a lot of people that establish a relationship with somebody are either, if you're a musician, they're trying to, hey, I want you to bring me a, to, I want to work with you. I want you to help me further my career, right? Or if it was, just ton of business people in and out of his life, there was a transactional relationship, and I never had a transactional relationship. It became more of a trusted friendship, and if anything, I would say he was like, just like he, I don't know, like just a teacher, a mentor, but also he was also, he's also very sensitive and vulnerable, and I could talk to him pretty much about anything,
Yeah, it sounded like
and
you protected your, you were clear to protect what you had and not in any way kind of violate that trust, which I think is so important for someone like he,
I do, I agree with you, Polly, and I think the good thing also was timing, because in timing, when Lou started to work with Master Ren in 2001 to slash 2002, around that time, I met Ren very early on in the process, and this was somebody who Lou was really interested in working with and was studying with and was learning so much. And I had I he introduced me to Ren, and Ren and I instantly had a great relationship, for because I think that A, I identify with Ren. We were around the same age, but he was from, we were from very different backgrounds. And we both kind of were in a position when working with Lou and helping him. Ren certainly helping him in the physical teaching of the martial arts. And, Lou is a real martial arts head. And Ren was kind of like a great leap from where he was at that point. In 2001, Ren just kind of like leapfrogged everything that he had learned prior, and then Lou was studying 6, 7 days a week, 3 hours a day.
incredible.
So he was helping him. I was working with Lou. Lou had some a couple of personal assistants, Priscilla Polly, who's in the book, who really was
Yes.
very trusted advisor slash protector of Lou, but also helped him. And so we all kind of found ourselves in these positions. That through that, I met Hal Wilner. I met, the bandmates, the producers, the record label people, Lori, of course.
Yeah.
And it just became this kind of like, we call it the Looniverse, but just,
I love it.
yeah, just this group of people that kind of were orbiting around Lou from different backgrounds, and I met a lot of really interesting people that way.
Yeah.
But to your point, always to protect a really good relationship, and also not to abuse it either. I mean, I think that that's also, it's very easy for someone to be introduced to all of this kind of this whole new world, and to kind of, hey, Lou, can I get this? Can I get, never. I just felt like that would be such a, hey, that wouldn't, I wouldn't do that to a friend. I wouldn't do that.
Exactly.
I grew up with, can I get this? Can I get that? No. So anyway,
Yeah,
if
that's a beautiful answer. Thank you. That really,
okay.
at the end, it's just about the, you're such a lover and such a fan of the music, and there's such integrity in that, and just protecting the beauty of what it is without trying to, you want to manipulate it. I'm interested in the process of making the book with the eds, as you call them. And how did it come about? How did you, I'm sure it was conversations and stuff, but that's one thing, but the actual act of really going through and doing it, how
Right.
did, who is kind of running that or spearheading things? I guess
So
the four of you.
the origins of the book started in 2008, 2009. I had been working with Atria Books on a different project, and Judith Kerr was our publisher. And at the time, Lou, Ren, Stefan, one of the other editors, and other folks, where we're trying to do different projects to help present and promote Tai Chi and our teachers' Tai Chi. And Lou was really kind of like, he was kind of the leader of that because he had the celebrity to be able to help him get in front of a larger audience. So, you know, he had brought him on tour in 2003, 2004, and
Incredible
had
to see him on stage with him. That was so cool.
it's amazing. It was just such a cool presentation of Tai Chi. At that point, I had been studying, and others had been studying. We had done some DVD work, some instructional videos. Anyway, long story short, the book was we met with Judith, our publisher, and she signed Lou to do a book about Tai Chi. Originally, thinking he was looking at something along the lines of creating this his version of Zen and the Art of Archery, but for Tai Chi,
Right.
taking kind of like that really cool kind of sublime path of presenting it in this way. And
68 then, right when he started writing it.
when he started writing it, he was, let's see, 2009, 4 years, he was 67.
Okay.
67. Yeah, 67. And I he had gotten very far with it. In the beginning, he started to do a little writing, a little kind of note, working with Ren to create notes, to start to create an outline, talking about the health aspects of it, talking about kind of the intersection between Tai Chi and other kind of, forces and meditation and, realizing power and energy and balance from this. So he started to do a little writing. Then in 2010, there was an article in the New York Times about yoga, and how yoga is wrecking everybody's body. So Lou and I said, let's do a letter to the editor from you to the Times. So in the beginning, with Lou, I was like, hey, I'll start the outline. He's like, okay. I started an outline. It was bullshit. I sent it to him. He after like 3 weeks, he sent back a fully realized, fully formed, beautiful letter that we printed in the book.
Oh, yes, I know. It's beautiful.
And that's like, you can't write for Lou Reed, right? So I was like, I even endeavored to do that. But anyway,
You got the ball rolling, though.
right. And that was that is exactly like getting things going, kind of being a catalyst. But he wrote this beautiful piece. They, of course, in their own, infinite wisdom, decided to pare it down to like three paragraphs because of space considerations. But the original, and they kept most of what we the idea of it, but the long letter, the full letter, really is like, that's his voice. That's Lou. And so I think, he had got done a little bit, bits and pieces of this, but never. And when he passed, there was just scattered in different notes. And subsequently, and Lori talks about this a lot when we talk about the Lou Reed archives, she found different notebooks of writing, whether it be on meditation or Tai Chi. And so he was writing, but it was really for himself, not necessarily to be shared in a book form. Or maybe he was intending to do, we don't know. But anyway, there was some more writing, which was great.
So great.
Yeah. So then we, so when he passed, I think the anniversary of his passing, the first anniversary of his passing, which is October of 2014, I was in Long Island with Lori. We were kind of celebrating the year anniversary, or celebrating or remembering, if you will. And I said, hey, this book, is there anything we can do with this? She said, well, funny that you should mention. I started to, look at all the things that are out there. Yeah, let's do this. So then we assembled the editors, Stefan, who knew Lou, worked with Lou when he was alive. He's based in DC. And then Bob Curry, who Lori had worked with and was working with and was a friend of Lou's. And then that became the Eds. And then we went back to the publisher and said, we'd like to pick this up where it was left off. Here's what we plan on doing. We created an outline. They said, we'd love to finish this. Let's do this. That was with Simon and Schuster and Atria at the time. But then Judith Kerr left in, I want to say, 2016, 15. And we we were working on the book, but we weren't happy with what was going on. So we kind of called her and said, "Would you mind taking us back, at your new at Harper One?" And she did. And we spent the next 7 years working on this.
Yeah, a long time, and what a
I
culmination of
know.
incredible conversations. I mean, and I'm sure there's a lot of moving parts and interviews. And I
Right.
noticed throughout the book that like different people interviewed different, like there were different voices interviewing or having conversations with different people. And so I'm wondering how that was determined. Was it just like I'll take that person, or was everybody reaching out to different people? Like, how did you organize that?
So we compiled a list of all the people we wanted to talk to, and it was an exhaustive list. I mean, we pretty much everybody who either had studied with him, taught him, helped him, his brother-in-law, his ex-wife, who really got him started in the martial arts, to help him with his health. So pretty much, I think we assembled a list of probably 80 plus people, and by and large, I would say 90% of all the interviews were conducted by the four editors, either through a conference call or in many instances, we did a lot of them in person in New York, at Laurie's studio or at Lou's home. So there's a few, maybe about four or five that were done individually by just the editors, just because of time considerations.
I see, but in some of most of them, you were all together interviewing them.
We were all together. We would prepare. We would, do our background information on who the people we were talking to and their relationship to Lou. And we would come up with a set of questions. And they oftentimes were very, they were just free. Quite honestly, there was a structure to it. But these conversations just really kind of expanded once we started because you really want them to talk. And, your questions are there to prompt different kind of areas that you want to cover. But we were delighted in all of these interviews. I don't think there was one interview that we didn't feel added something to the story. So, and that's what I think. That's why I think the book is so special because I think that it's very personal.
Oh, so personal, and it must have brought each of you. I mean, he's such a strong, it's such a strong energy. And I'm wondering in that process, it must have felt so soothing and nice to kind of reinvoke his spirit through these conversations and just be with him in a different way.
Yeah, no, what a great point, Polly. It is hearing his voice on some of these, we had recorded each other a lot when we talked about Tai Chi, when we were doing all these different projects back in the mid-00s. Hearing his voice and hearing people talk about their interaction with him not only did create a closer relationship, but it reminded me of how physical a relationship I had with him and others had with him, because when you study martial arts with somebody and you're kind of, sparring or you're practicing and he's teaching and he's saying, "All right, you hold your hand like this." Now I'm showing this as audio, but it's a very physical kind of relationship in a way where you never forget that. You never forget that the mind body memory, if you will. I don't know if that's correct, but and I think that I'm a little regretful that I didn't bring more of that thought to the book, because I think that's, it was very, it's a physical thing. Like the people I studied with, like Lou and Tony and just Master Ren and others, it was just very, like, I remember their hands. And Lori brings it up a lot. She brings up hands, like the rock and roll hands, the guitar hands that Lou had. And it's just kind of getting into that mind of thinking that way is just does create a very intimate portrait of another, of a person, but also of your relationship.
And she talks about actually, I was reading about at the end when she says he died on a Sunday morning looking at the trees and doing the famous 21 form of Tai Chi with just his musician hands moving through the air. And I just
Yeah.
thought that's so beautiful. I mean, that's such a gorgeous, just I could just see him, beautiful.
Incredible. It really, it's a, what a way to go if you, when you
What a
have to
way to
go
go.
doing that, right? It's pretty
Jeez.
special.
So the conversation, there's so many we couldn't tap into each one, but I just wanted to go through a few of the names and just for people who may not have read the book who are listening or watching. I wanted to start with Tony Visconti, of course. And he talked one, first of all, one of my favorite quotes from the book is yours, "Everyone's straight line is different." And I think it's such a beautiful articulation of what this book is, because although there's this practice, there's still this wonderful freedom in it, and everybody's able to be who they are. And it wasn't that what his music was all about anyway, you know? So I
Agree.
love that. So thank you for that quote. But one thing Tony said is chi does not travel through a tense body. And he talked about the three benefits: health, meditation, and self-defense. And just, you know, you read so much about Lou Reed and the tension a lot of times that he had, you know, when he was here on the Vineyard, he performed at the Hot Tin Roof and got upset because, you know, he had talked earlier in the day about wanting to play from his heart. He was doing some acoustic stuff at the time. And I guess I have friends who went to the show that night and there were too many people. It was a small venue. They were crowding him and he was, you know, and he erupted and like he did many times, as you, I'm sure you're well aware. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to what Tony talks about with chi not traveling through a tense body. And as I learn more about it, I'm wondering, was that what he was working toward, is help when he would get stuck with that energy or that angst? Would Tai Chi help him flow and release so he could, you know, energetically be more smooth in his life? Like, what is that what he was trying to work toward, do you think? Or anybody?
I can only speak for myself and kind of what relate to Tony's quote in the sense of right, your mind and your body is relaxed, and that's kind of to help you release the chi and find the chi. That's the way to do it. But a tense body is a much, you know, you're creating blockages for that to happen. But for Lou, the thing one of the interesting things that Lori brought up was that Lou started, you know. He had this side of him that where he would have anger, you know, he would be angry, but as he kind of worked through all of that, the anger and the resolution would oftentimes meet right at the same time. So you wouldn't even necessarily see that he had worked toward that. Did Tai Chi help him and meditation help him to kind of resolve this? I would think so, but I don't think he never said that to me. But Tony's point is really spot on in the sense of that's what's so special about this martial art. It's almost like a gift to yourself and to your body and to your mind to kind of like take a vacation. And I think Lou enjoyed that. I know he did. I don't think that. I know he did. I saw him and he encouraged me to enjoy it too. And I think that's why I think it's such a special book, because we're talking about somebody who found this incredible kind of art, you know, to help them become healthier, clearer, more well balanced, to find their energy. So
Yeah, and he seemed very, is it Ramuncha? Ramuncho?
Ramuncho Mata.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I loved that interview and him. And he talked about in 1979, it was somewhere around Union Square, he was sitting with Lou and William Burroughs. And William Burroughs said, "You can see people's energies." And Lou was like, "Yeah, totally. Like, you can just see the three of them sitting there." And I think Lou, it sounds like, I mean, he was a genius, as many have stated in this book, but you can see that like interest that he had, at least through these interviews, in so many different ways, and people's energy and bringing them in. And like when you're talking about how when you met him and he trusted you, he seemed to have a great read on people's energies. He's so super, super sensitive.
Yeah.
So I loved, I don't know Ramuncho, that well, but it sounds like they connected on that very, like they had that mystic and Mallorca that they were into, and like it sounded like a really interesting just connection around energy.
Yeah, definitely a deep relationship certainly through the martial arts and through Tai Chi. At Ramuncho, that interview took place in probably two or three different sessions. Lori doing part of it on her own in Paris when she was there, gosh, I don't remember when. We had then done a follow-up interview with him over the phone, in a conference call. We were in New York, he was in Paris. And Romancho, I had met Romancho in 2011 when I accompanied Lou on tour in Paris. And like anybody, like I was, it's interesting. I never even thought of it until we started to do the book, who I had met over the years. And I didn't realize that he had a center for study of Tai Chi just outside of Paris. And he really brought so much. He brought so much kind of rich imagery to this conversation we were having about Lu and Tai Chi. And I think you see in the book a few of his draw his watercolor paintings are in the book. One is Lu doing Tai Chi in the afterlife.
Oh, I love it.
It's amazing, actually. I mean, it's just, gosh, I wish I could have a copy of that. It's just such a beautiful expression. But he really brought so many interesting ideas to this book. Romancho did, and his relationship with Lou, but also his relationship with the martial arts and his relationship with health and his experience and background, with illness. And I just find it, yeah, it's very personal.
Yeah, I'm wondering, was he the one who Lou went over to France when he was ill and he found a doctor? There was a doctor, a French doctor he went to, who was giving him like herbal
Yeah.
supplements. Yeah, I
Yeah.
think.
Well, when Lou had was diagnosed with all of his issues, folks like Lou would, we talk about this in the book, Lou seeking out different treatments, whether it was in Boston or Japan or France or New York, Cleveland Clinic, you know, and that was one of the nice things about the book. We kind of talk about that without, of course, violating kind of his privacy, but also just talked about his desire to find magic, to find something that would help him.
Yes, he was such a seeker. Jonathan Richman, I thought that was an interesting how they talked about. He said they would just let me study them, like I could come hang out and I could watch them. And I thought that was gracious of them. And they it sounds like they did have a falling out, which tend to happen. But clearly, like he was in college, right? When they just he was able to just be with them.
Yeah, a teenager. Actually, he I think he met them when he was 17 or 18. And he said he I think he had seen them perform, the Velvets perform, starting in 1967, maybe 70 shows in
Incredible.
Boston, in the, you know,
Yeah.
Massachusetts area. So Jonathan was a really, he for me is one of my favorite interviews because, A, as a fan of his music over the years, but also just kind of it was my opportunity to kind of talk to him and share with him kind of, you know, here's who I am, here's how I'm part of this, and to hear his story about how he met Lou and the other band members, and just to hear his story. I had no idea about the falling out or what had happened, but also the reconciliation that Penn Jillette orchestrated at the Lone Star Cafe
Yes.
in 1992. I was at that show.
Really?
Oh, I didn't see Lou there because he was on this side stage. He was probably, it was a small club. And I spoke to Jonathan at that show. I introduced myself and just, I said, hey, just big fan. And yeah, I still talk to him because we talk about different things that we're thinking about doing with respect to helping promote the book and kind of bring Tai Chi to a larger audience, with the book itself as kind of the basis of that. And I've been speaking to him about different things that we may be able to involve him with. And he's pretty busy right now touring himself, but he's just very gracious and open and pretty honest. He's also somebody who's very difficult to get in touch with because he doesn't have a computer or a smartphone or a cell
Oh
phone.
no, not that.
Everything is either a voicemail, leave him a voicemail, he'll call back, or letters.
Oh, interesting.
Doesn't that make sense? Because you know Jonathan Richman, it's kind of,
Totally.
he's lo-fi, he's unplugged, he's not, he said, I can't, this is not for me.
Absolutely. And thank goodness, because I think it really
Right.
works for him. Sharon Felder, who is the daughter of Doc Thomas, is that right?
Yes.
And she, I loved her quote. She said, "Even his anger was beautiful because there was truth in it." And I think that's so true with his music and his anger and the way he lived his life. So honest.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Sharon, well, Sharon is a friend of all of ours. She's such a big supporter of of Lou and the book. Have you seen the documentary that she did about her dad?
No, I didn't know there was one.
Gosh, I wish I don't remember the title, but
I'll find it.
it's so it is beautiful. It is a great kind of story about her dad and kind of his just his kind of like as a songwriter, but also the struggles he had because of his health.
Yeah.
But and just how many people he touched and just talk about being real. And he and Lou struck a relationship up. That's part of what Sharon describes is kind of late in his in Doc's life, starting to befriend and work with Lou and not work with Lou, but have a relationship with him. And you know, the record Magic and Loss.
Yes, and what's good, right? Wasn't that, yeah.
And but Sharon and Lou were friends, and she also has a place out in Long Island, and they would spend a lot of their free time together, whether it was in Manhattan, but mostly out on Long Island, just you know, hanging out.
Yeah, right. It was it the Springs was where they is
I
where
believe
the place is.
so. Yeah, somewhere in Southampton or East Hampton.
So beautiful. And then I loved your interview or your talk with Ann Waldman,
Ah.
which was so cool. And I love that you asked her what he was like back, you know, because that was pre, it predated a lot of people. So she sounded
Yeah.
like she was totally into him. Like he
She,
was sexy and super.
she's amazing. Like, so we see, I see Anne a lot, or not a lot, but I see her when we do these different events. For we, the Lunaverse gathers twice a year, usually once on the anniversary of his passing and then on his birthday in March. And so oftentimes the group kind of gets together, or, you know, and it's just always nice. But Ann Waldman, I was aware of Ann Waldman just, you know, and through college and through kind of my exploration of the New York music and poetry scene. Jim Carroll, who, you know, was also a friend, a poet friend of Lou's, but also the Basketball Diaries and Forced Entries, different books. And I had interviewed Jim Carroll when I was in college. So I was so deep. That's why I always say, like, this relationship with Lou really, when I was, or to his music when I was 18, really started me on everything that I'm doing today. And I told him that I was like, I was a journal. I wanted to be a journalism major because I wanted to report what I saw. Like, I saw that in his music. And I studied down in DC at GW with a poli sci minor. But, I was really interested in the whole beat scene and the whole New York punk scene and the whole kind of just that whole mindset that really started with Lou for me. And that's how I met these people. So Ann Waldman was very, very important to Jim Carroll in his career. So when I got to interview her, I was like, oh, I want to ask you a lot of questions, not just about Lou, but other things. And she's very open, gracious, and you know.
You did a beautiful job. It really brought me in. I mean, I was able to really feel. And she was so, she gave such a sense of what it was like to be in his orbit back then, which I loved. I got a chance to listen to Hal Wilner and their New York Shuffle, the radio show they did. I
Yeah.
listened to the last episode, which was incredible. I didn't know about it, so I wish I had. I'm going to go back and listen. But Hal said Lou made me a producer, and he said in the book that Lou said to him, "I don't like many people, but I like you." And it sounds like that's how he vibed, you know. But what a great guy he sounds like. And he died, well, wasn't it Hal Wilner, Bill O'Connor, and Mick Rock died while you were making the book?
Yeah, all folks that we had interviewed, Hal was in so many ways like, gosh, it's just so hard to think that he's not with us anymore because He was such an important part of this whole story. Even though he didn't study art, martial arts, or Tai Chi, he was just very present throughout when I knew Lu through that relationship and saw their relationship grow. I think he was a producer on his record from 2000, Ecstasy. He had first started working with him in 1985, 86 on Lost in the Stars, the Kurt Weill compilation. Anyway, Hal's story is just so special and so great. And he had such an interesting relationship with Lou. And just being around Hal, and I spent a lot of time with Hal, just Hal and I over the years, is just fascinating. He was like an encyclopedia of everything, music, film, TV, comedy, puppetry, and
Incredible.
anything. This whole world of kind of like, there was always a comedic element to it, and always just an appreciation of like the beats. And you know, he did the record with Burroughs and Ginsberg. And just talking to Hal was always fascinating. But the last time I saw Hal was in 2019 when we did the first official Lu Ri Tai Chi Day at in Brooklyn at the library, and then at Prospect Park. And Hal and Lori and the Eds, we helped coordinate a whole program for the morning and the evening.
Wow,
And
that's so cool.
I hadn't seen Hal in a long time, and because I had moved to Montana in 2013, so I maybe seen him. We had interviewed him for the book, but in 2017, 18, it was just I reconnected with him, and it was he was showing me some new things he was working on, and new, that were using puppetry and animation and a new show he was trying to get produced. And it was funny. Polly, it was like only as Hal could do things. And it was just, it's like that was my remembrance of him, which is a nice fond one, a sweet one.
Yeah.
But I just, it's hard to think that he's not with us.
And when did he pass? What year?
Right at the beginning of COVID in 2020, in March
Oh.
or April of 2020.
I can imagine he and Lou had a really tight relationship, having such vast knowledge, each of them. Incredible love for music and arts and everything.
Well, if you listen to those shuffles, that's their relationship. The conversation that they were having is the conversation that I've often heard.
Yeah, who said, how one of them said in the book, or must have been Hal said, it was like we forgot we were on the radio. It was day. We had
Right.
no idea where we were.
That was great. And we, you know, it's so amazing because it was pre-podcast, right? So it was was actually wasn't. There were podcasts, but it wasn't as universally connected to as it is today, in terms of how people consume audio. But it was just broadcast on Sirius and then repeated. But I think if you go on YouTube, you could find a lot of them.
Yeah, it's a really it's like a cache of wonderful I also saw his well, I'll move on to that, and I don't want to keep you because I know that I just want to hear more and more, but I know that it's morning time there, so I have a weird question about I recently interviewed Chris France. The drummer for Talking Heads. And in his book, which is such a great book, Remain in Love, he talks about in 1975 when they were just starting out at CBGB's, and he was a huge Lou Reed fan, of course. But just that whole CBGB's culture back then. And Lou, one night, he has it in the book where Lou invited them back to his place on the Upper East Side, his apartment.
Right.
A great chapter. And he talks about how Lou got up and walked to the kitchen and got a quart of Häagen-Dazs and sat on the floor and like ate it in front of them while they were all there's only a couch in the apartment, so they're all the three of them, David Byrne and Chris France and Tina Weymouth, they're sitting on the couch and he's Lou Reed's on the floor like eating this quart of Häagen-Dazs in front of them. But it's in I wanted to ask you because and he said Lou Reed told us that a band was like a fist. It could be very powerful, but that the record companies would always try to manipulate and massage one finger away from the others and break apart. And eventually he talked to them. They went to breakfast that day. His manager at the time was Johnny Padel. And
Lose at the time, right?
whose manager was. And
Right.
so Lou was interested in producing their first record. And they ended up going with Sire, and they stayed with Sire the whole their whole all of their albums, their studio albums. They stayed with them, and I saw that Lou moved to Sire. This is such a nerdy question, but I saw he ended up moving to Sire right around 1988 or 89, when before New York. And as someone from the music industry, do you feel like that was a big change for him? And Sire seemed to work so well. And I talked to Chris France about how much they loved Sire. And just wondering just what your thoughts are on that. It's a kind of a weird, a big question, but.
Well, as a fan of Lou's, I would say that, yeah, that was a great move because it started an incredible creative period. And I want to say that Bill Bentley, who was Lou's confidant and publicist, he's in our book. Bill talks a lot about his meeting Lou for the first time around the time that I think it was Seymour Stein signed Lou. What a just a special relationship that was. And I think
Seymour
he,
Stein was amazing.
right, amazing, and it's an artist-friendly experience. And I think you hear a lot of that when you talk about artists that were on Sire in those days. I think the Ramones were on Sire too, Madonna, and the Talking Heads and Lou. And yeah, I think that that was an incredible period. And if you ever speak to Sylvia Reed, his ex-wife. She talks a lot about that period as well. There's a podcast out there right now that she does with two of the designers that helped design several of the records over the years. Yeah, Spencer Drait and Judith South. I apologize. I don't want to butcher her last name, but look it for it. It's really good. And Sylvia does an amazing job talking about kind of the art and presentation of his material through
Oh, that's great.
this great period of time.
It's a great recommendation because I thought it was interesting because in Chris's book, Lou's trying to get, I think he was with. Who was who? Oh, BMF. He was
BMG.
BMG. So Lou was trying to get them to come to his label. They didn't end up doing it. And
Oh, to RCA. At the time, Lou was on RCA, but
RCA, that's what it was. And so the talking, he talks about, Chris France talks about how they declined and they ended up not doing that. But it's so interesting to me that Lou eventually did go to Sire with Seymour Stein and all that. So it kind of worked backwards a little bit. Such a good story, and hearing him eating the Häagen-Dazs with them in the apartment. So great. So great. And then just two more questions. I wanted to ask, and maybe I don't know if that's a sensitive question, but was Patti Smith, I would think she would have been wanting to be part of this, or is that.
I don't know that. I think, honestly, I'm sure there was a list and she may have or may have not been on it. We may have asked her and she may have said yes. I don't know what, no, or whatever. I don't know. I don't know, but I always love hearing her stories, especially when she inducted
I
them.
was just going to mention that. I watched it last night. Incredible.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yo, no, yeah. She, that's, those are just two special, especially the one. From when she inducted him in, I think it was 2015,
15. Oh.
was really a very personal story.
Unbelievable. And she kind of speaks. Perfect Day, the lyrics. So beautiful.
Yeah, thank God for Patty. In traveling with Lou over the years, one of my favorite, maybe not have been the most technically the best show. But there was a show in 2011. It was called Hop Farm, and it was in Kent, England. And on the bill the same night was like my heroes was Lou. Well, Lou was it was Lou, Patty, and Iggy.
Ah,
Okay, and the
love
only
it.
thing missing was David Bowie. But it was that was such a special night because we had Lou had gone on. He went on after everyone, and I got to see all three sets. And
Amazing.
I just and he was working on the Lulu record at that time, and he really didn't stick around after the show. He kind of flew off to Norway, I think, to do some photo photo work for the Lulu record that was going to come out later in the year. But boy, I wish the three of them had just that we had gotten that picture.
Oh, I know. Oh, that would have been great. I was watching this American Masters interview with her, and I wrote down the quote. She said, "He had a way of taking mounds of knowledge and paring it down to a few lines with simple, beautiful, direct language." And she talks about the song "Heroine" as a perfect example and perfect American song, beautifully masculine with this very feminine rhythm. And I wanted to just before we end, I just want to ask you about a couple songs, that one being the first one from the Velvet Underground and Nico. And if you could just speak a little bit about, I don't know, as a fan, what your connection is with a song like that, and what does it mean to you and in your framework.
Sure. So, I mean, I think the lyrics to me were, have always been the most important thing. So, I love music, obviously, but the lyrics, the direct to the point that you said about Patti Smith, direct and also just so real, like painting a very realistic picture, which in many ways, like journalism, like good journalism, is presenting kind of like this is what this is, not taking a moral stance and saying here is what this is. And so I found his music to be so incredibly, I don't know, just so moving to me because it really just, the way my mind works is he's describing what it means to, what it's like to do this or to observe this. And he's also talking about people that you may not hear a lot about in contemporary music or in contemporary literature or contemporary f in film. And that's why what he did was so, I would think, so groundbreaking is that he kind of he followed suit that Hubert Sulby and William Burroughs and others had kind of charted the path through literature, and he kind of extended that to music. So I love a song that's one of my favorite songs, and it's interesting. A lot of people have maybe first heard that song through the Rock and Roll Animal presentation of the song, which was a totally different arrangement band energy. Right. And I mean, it's so interesting when you think coming from the music industry, you realize like an album like Rock and Roll Animal exists because it helped expand him beyond the cult status of the Velvets at the time to a mainstream audience. You know, of course, started with Walk on the Wild Side and Transformer, but then this kind of kicked open the door. And there was this heavy metal presentation of this incredible song.
And that's such an important album for you personally, I know as well, Rock and Roll Animal, right?
It was the first. It was the door opener for, and for many people, it was when you start to talk to listen, read some of the fan groups, you realize that was their first introduction to Lou.
Moving on to Magic and Loss, I wanted to ask you about What's Good. We touched on it a little bit earlier, but what's your understanding, or how do you feel about that whole, the
What's good?
album, of course, but that song?
What's good? Space without room. What's a disease that won't hurt you? What won't hurt you? What's good? Nothing at all. I don't. I probably the wrong lyrics. But anyway,
No, totally.
I saw Lou perform that in 1992 slash 90 no 92 at Radio City Music Hall, and this is when he was presenting a record from start to finish, which people were pissed off about. They were like, "What do you mean you're sitting me down and like?" He was presenting it like, you know, it's a story, and here's the different chapters of the story, which he had always said that's kind of how he saw this,
Love it.
the album form. And I was just struck by that. I was also struck by the fact that Jimmy Scott was on that record. And again, through Lou, introduced to this incredible s vocalist, which, by the way, that's 1992, that he helped Jimmy get his record deal signed with Sire, I want to say, with Syl
Interesting.
Bentley. And in many ways, and I had accompanied Lou to a concert that Anoni had done at Carnegie Hall in the mid 2000s, and Jimmy Scott was on that bill and had met Jimmy Scott that night.
Oh, that cool. It's funny because Barbara Dacey in the interview with Lou, Jimmy Scott had come here to MBY and they talked about that and connected with it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's cool.
Oh, how that's a great interview she did. Because I could, in listening to that interview, he was very relaxed and appreciated her energy around his music.
I agree. I told her the same thing. She really met him where he was and didn't try to be like the interviewer. She just hung.
Right.
It's great.
And you could tell he was so relaxed in that conversation. It's just so nice to hear.
Oh, nice.
What other songs? I love
Oh,
talking about this.
I know I do not want to though overstay my welcome with you, but The Power of the Heart, because that Laurie said that was the last song he wrote, and that was their song, or he wrote it for her for their wedding, right?
Well, I want to say that, I forget the first release of that song was, I think it was in the mid to late 2000s. And, it took on I don't know, I think there was different arrangements of it. I think it's a beautiful song. You could feel the Tai Chi and the meditation and kind of the just love, the bursting, the overfilling of the heart and the love in that song. And
Is it on an album or anything? Or I couldn't find like what it was connected
not a
to.
Peter Gabriel album. I think he did
Yeah, I saw that he
it
covered that.
in
Beautiful.
Salisbury Hill, but then I don't know. I think it was maybe released as a single. It's on Spotify and it's on all the streaming platforms.
Yeah. Interesting.
No, I want to say, geez, I thought that there was an arrangement of it that a producer did, but that's a different song.
Yeah. No worries. I mean, I was just listening to the Journeymen, by the way. I loved your conversation with them. They're great. I didn't even know about that until I was digging around and found you with them. They're so funny and so
Wait,
knowledgeable.
what was that?
The Journeymen podcast, the two
Oh,
guys.
Jokerman.
Oh, Jokerman. Oh my gosh. Why did I? Oh, Jer it's funny. I wrote Journeymen. Jokerman. I love them. And
They're
it was
great.
so such a great interview with you. But I mean, for me, New York, I lived in the Chelsea Hotel in 87 and 88, and New York was a huge album for me. And they just did a great episode about the album, which, of course everyone loves it, but I'd love to hear your perspective. I mean, that album just for
Is
me
that
was
on New
just.
York or on so New York? But first of all, back to the Jokerman, Ian and Evan are the principals of that, and they are just so smart and so knowledgeable and so steeped
I
in
know.
music. But not and it's funny because they're obviously younger than me, younger than you. They have an appreciation for not just the music, but they always look at the video, the graphic elements of a record, the video elements of a record, and all these different kind of connections to a record that you might not think of, and they're just so thoughtful. And I can't speak about them highly enough about them. I mean, I listen to their podcast every time they have a new one.
I
They're now
love
into
it.
Steely Dan,
Yes.
and Brian Eno kind of like tributary off of the main river of Lou and Dylan and the Velvet. But
Love it. The three of you were the perfect match because you were both also the three of you so knowledgeable, and they were so happy to have you. And it's just such a joy to hear, something like that that's so well researched and so beautiful.
yeah, they're great, but the New York record, back to your question, New York record, I was finishing up college and he had performed that again in its entirety from start to finish, and then his second set was just some of the favorites. But I had seen that performed in DC actually at the Warner Theater in 1989.
Wow, the whole thing. And he did it. The first set was the whole album.
From start to finish, like Derrida
Jeez.
into Romeo had, I think it's Romeo had Juliet.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's just like talk about like the power of writing and the music all coming together to describe a period of time
Know.
that you live through,
The
that I live through,
masterpiece.
right? And they did a reissue of it with a couple of years ago. I think it was the 30th anniversary. 30th, geez, for it, no, 30th.
That
Gosh,
right?
I don't even know. But anyway, they did a reissue through the archive that Laurie put together with Jason and Don, Jason Stern and Don Fleming. at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center for Performing Arts. And so people that are in New York who are listening to this should please make a visit there. I think you need to make an appointment. I don't know, but anyway, that came from that reissue and kind of with all the extended tracks and information came from the archives.
I was gonna, so that was my one of my last questions is about the archives because it's a little bit confusing because I know there was an exhibit of because I saw it and it was amazing and all these different like objects and things and stuff like that, but that's now closed. Is that right? That's no longer. So it are the archives open now at
They
the
are
public library, that location, or is it
at
somewhere
Lincoln
else?
Center. No, at Lincoln Center.
Oh, at
So it's
Lincoln.
at the, it's on the third floor or the second floor at Lincoln Center. The I think it's the Performing Arts Library branch of the New York Public Library.
Oh, I'm so glad you told me that because I was trying to figure out. It's a little in the material. It's a little tough to understand exactly where it is. But what
Right.
is that like?
It's amazing. So the exhibit was incredible. I mean, it was just so deep and so there was different, you know, the different aspects of his life. And I, you know, you got a Lori, Jason, and Don assembled that with the public library. That now is no that that is it's run its course.
Right.
And I don't know if they're planning on taking it to other cities. I thought I remember them saying something about taking it maybe to Europe, but I don't know what the plan is for that. But you can go to the New York Public Library and dig into those archives. That's where I actually found
Open invitation.
an invitation, which I got it wrong in the book, and we since corrected it. It was from 1984, the New Sensations sessions.
Oh.
And that would make sense because Lou was studying with Master Lungshom and Peter Morales, his brother-in-law at the time, or his
Right.
brother-in-law. And that's what the song's about. But it's just it's pure Lou.
What
I
a
mean,
song. I've totally been playing it on the air and I'm just like, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe this has been unearthed and you were the one. Were you just like going through recordings and happened upon it or what?
so we were meeting in New York. The Eds were meeting, and prior to our meeting, I went to the library to just to explore the archives, and because I hadn't seen it yet, and I was just listening to a bunch of random tracks, and this thing came through, and I immediately texted Lori and the Eds and said, "I think I found something here. Do we know about this? Because it's unlabeled." And she's like, "Oh yeah, this is new. This is fantastic." So we were excited
Oh.
because we had heard about it. One of the our subjects talked about that
Oh.
Lou had written a song for Tai Chi, but they don't remember when it was or where he did it, and this was the track.
Incredible. Thank you so much for finding
Thank
that
you.
because it's
Thank you
such a
for
beautiful
liking
song.
it. I mean, look, how great is it to hear? It's one of my favorite records, New Sensations, and just to hear something
Yeah.
from that same time frame was just wonderful.
Oh, the whole thing. And one thing I wanted to mention too is I've really been enjoying the Hudson River Wind Meditations on Sounds True, which are really, I think, vibrationally so powerful.
Yeah.
But he just kind of, and it reminded me a little bit of Lori, like I've seen a couple of her installations in that vibratory like thing that they do. It's so
Yeah.
cool.
We were brought he's we studied that in class, so that was the backdrop. And certainly in the later years from 2007 to I think onward, we use that as our kind of like soundtrack to learn and study with Master Ren.
Was that his intention? Is that why he created them?
He created it for himself, but then Ren encouraged him to bring it to class for the rest of us to listen to. And some people didn't like it because they were used to the traditional Chinese music to practice to that, but many of us just enjoyed it. It was very centering, so.
Yeah, it really is. And are you still in touch with Master Ren? And
Oh yes,
yeah,
yes.
very much so.
I speak to him every couple of weeks. I live in Montana. He's in New York. He's now in China. He's going to China for a couple of months. But I speak to him all the time, and just he's a very special friend to myself, to my family, and
Okay.
Tori and others. So yeah.
And lastly, are there any plans yet in the works for Lou Reed International Tai Chi Day on March 2nd of this coming year? Are there any,
Next year.
I mean, next year in March, are there any plans in place yet or?
I don't, you know what? We have a couple of things that we're working on, including we'll definitely do something around his birthday next year, but then also we had been talking about maybe next year doing something more of a an exhibit, kind of taking the program of Luri Tai Chi Day and taking it to other places, maybe to universities and colleges, and just kind of thinking our way through that. How can we do that in a first of all, cost-effective way, but also in a way where it's a presentation of Tai Chi and music and everything
Yeah.
we've done.
He would love that because that was his intention in the first place, right? It's just to get more people aware of Tai Chi and
Right.
yeah,
Exactly.
understanding it. Oh, well, thank you so much for that and for just being so gracious with your time.
Thank
But
you.
what an honor. And just please know we are all reading and loving the book, and we'll be reading it, our listeners, and playing the music and continuing to love to read. And you
Thank
know.
you. I'm honored to speak to you as well, and speak to your fellow students, I guess, or the people that are interested in this book. And please feel free to you have my email. Let them have my email if they have any questions. I'm happy
Oh,
to help.
great. Oh,
Yes.
that's a great idea. And then I'm just gonna stop recording real quick.
Sure.